doors, which eventually opened out into a main walkway. The shiny floors squeaked under every footstep, and the smell of chemical hand cleanser prickled Alex's nose. She couldn't begin to calculate how many ill people there were right now, all coughing and complaining into this same block of warm air. As she came to the thick double doors of Bramble Ward, Alex dropped a big gloop of disinfectant hand gel so it sat like ketchup in her palm. She rubbed it slowly and carefully into her skin. Alex pushed the doors open, past the empty reception desk, and tiptoed quietly up to the open office door. Giving a gentle knock, she waited for the nurses inside to finish their conversation. Inside, the radio was burbling with mid-morning local news updates. A breezy voice announced the arrest of a wanted rapist, the results of a successful school fundraising event, and the timescale for extended roadworks on the A21. After a minute or so, she knocked again. Eventually, one of the nurses came out, as Alex made a fist to knock one last time.
"Oh, sorry, you should have knocked," said the nurse, despite looking straight at Alex's unfurling fist.
Alex tried to peer into the office to see if the ward manager she'd met last time was in there, but she was nowhere to be seen.
"I don't think we've met. I'm Alex Dale. I'm a journalist. I visited before because I'm writing about Dr. Haynes's work."
"I'm Gillian Radson, and I wasn't aware there'd be journalists on my ward today," replied the nurse, pursing her lips.
"I've just been interviewing Dr. Haynes, and he's agreed that I can write a piece on one of your patients, Amy Stevenson."
"I'll have to check that with him," replied the nurse.
"Sure," said Alex. "But while I'm here, I wondered if I could sit with Amy."
"She has someone with her at the moment."
Alex tried to see into the corner cubicle, but there were pillars in all the wrong places.
"I didn't think she had any relatives."
Nurse Radson crossed her cardigan over her chest, folding her thick, flat arms.
"He's not a relative. He's one of our sitters."
She sighed at Alex's blank expression.
"Volunteers. They come and spend time with the patients."
"Oh, okay. Maybe I could speak with him?"
Alex suggested, opening her bloodshot eyes as widely and innocently as she could manage. Alex sensed the answer was no, and that if the nurse could speak freely, the answer would be more like fuck off.
"Wait there," she sighed. "I'll go and ask."
Nurse Radson, with her apple tummy upholstering the tight, sexless, striped blue uniform, marched off towards Amy's cubicle. Inches at a time, Alex shuffled along so that she could see Amy's curtains clearly, noticing the man's foot tapping under the gap. The nurse pulled the curtain back sharply, and Alex could see that a tall, sandy-haired guy was sitting on the bed, holding Amy's hand. He was wearing a blue hoodie, with a hospital-issued visitor's badge dangling from his neck. As the sitter dropped Amy's hand, Alex could see the nurse stooping to talk in his ear. The man and the nurse both shot Alex a look at the same time. After a minute, the nurse came back over to where Alex was trying to look nonchalant. Perhaps weighing up whether to complain about Alex moving from her original spot, the nurse shook her head and said,
"I'm sorry, but he says the volunteering he does here is personal, and he'd rather not talk to you."
"Can I have a quick word and explain that I can interview him anonymously?" Alex tried.
"No, look."
The nurse took a deep breath, her irritation barely concealed.
"I'm sorry, but that won't be possible. He gives his time out of the goodness of his heart, and he's a nice man."
She rolled the words around her mouth slowly.
"I'm not going to risk his goodwill by letting people bother him when he's already said no."
Knowing when to call it quits, Alex passed the nurse her card to give to the sitter, just in case, and slinked back out of the ward. It was almost noon now, anyway, and she needed to get home.
Chapter 6. Jacob. 8th of September, 2010. Jacob's heart raced He had been sitting with Amy for too long. He knew that. Nonetheless, he hadn't expected that nosy nurse to yank the curtains back so suddenly. He hoped it wasn't obvious that he was holding Amy's tiny hand, something he didn't do with most of the patients he sat with. As casually as possible, Jacob uncurled their fingers and dropped her hand, palm facing up, fingers bent. Gillian Radson was full of her usual bluster. "I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's a journalist over there, and she wants to talk to you," she puffed. Jacob was still recovering from the interruption. "A journalist wants to talk to me? Why would a journalist want to talk to me?" "Don't worry," soothed the nurse. "She's writing an article about one of the doctors, and she's interested in this one's story. She wanted to sit with Amy, but I explained that you were with her, so she asked to speak to you." In unrehearsed synergy, Jacob and the nurse both shot the journalist a look. Jacob had been thoroughly unprepared for this. He stared at the nurse, waiting for her to tell him what to do. "Don't worry. You don't have to talk to her. I can get rid." Nurse Radson smiled. "No one knows I come here," he faltered. "Volunteering is a private thing, and to be honest, I come here in work hours and I could get in a bit of bother if it got back to my boss." The corners of Nurse Radson's mouth twitched. As he watched her thick buttocks heave up and down like piston engines marching back to the visitor, Jacob finally exhaled. He stood up and slowly and quietly tugged the curtains to a close again. Then he sat back down, picked up Amy's skinny hand and pressed its cold skin to his face. He said nothing, because there was nothing new to say, but he closed his eyes and drank in her almost vanished smell. With the lightest touch, he kissed her paper-thin skin and slowly laid her hand palm down on her stomach. After stroking her newly brushed hair and coughing away the lump in his throat, Jacob backed out and took a long blink. He was ready to leave, but Jacob couldn't let Amy be his last patient. There were currently 9 patients, so he let Amy be his 7th and chose the 2 nearest the door as penultimate and final. There was an extra incentive to do it this way, as patient number 8, Claude Johnson, 62, had an incredibly devoted wife. 9 times out of 10, she would be there, holding Claude's red raw hands, talking to him about last night's Coronation Street, or rolling her eyes about the neighbours. Jacob would offer to sit with Claude, to give Julie Johnson a break, but she never accepted. Patient 9, Natasha Carroll, was a happy ending. She was 42 and still striking. Her hair was a light gold with delicate greying strands that sparkled silver in the sunlight. Natasha had been in this ward for a few years, and before that she had been in intensive care. Jacob remembered the day she was transferred in. At the time, he had been sitting with Joan Reeves, since deceased. It wasn't long after he and Fiona had returned from their honeymoon, and the fading tan on his hands had looked ridiculous against Joan's lilac-white skin. Today, Jacob sat down on the chair next to Natasha's bed. He placed his vending machine Dr. Pepper bottle, its inch of brown liquid now warm and unwanted, on the small beach bedside cabinet. Natasha had been propped on her side slightly, her eyes open and peaceful. Her knees pointed towards Jacob's chair. Golden hair lay slightly matted at the back, but curled in waves around her neck and mouth. With the sunlight oozing through the nearby window, she looked like a stained glass Madonna. "Hello, Natasha," Jacob said in hushed tones. He pulled the curtains casually, leaving them askew so that the nurses could see him going about his business, behaving breezily. He knew more details than he wanted about some of the patients' backgrounds, mainly from their abandoned partners. About others, like Natasha, he knew very little. She looked so peaceful, bathed in the pastels and whites of the hospital. She wore a dressing gown that looked like cashmere or something similar, and silk pajamas from a collection of similar pajamas that he knew was several pairs deep. Some of the patients Jacob had sat with over the years had faces filled with trauma, gargoyles bearing the weight of witness. Not Natasha, who looked like a contented house cat, totally assured of comfort and safety. Over the years, Jacob hadn't seen anyone else visit Natasha, but every once in a while a new vase of incredibly expensive-looking flowers would appear at her bedside and birthday cards would tumble over themselves annually. He talked in his hushed but sing-song hospital voice, telling Natasha all about Fiona's baby bump and his job. Talking to her about things he never broached with Amy. Natasha lay coiled, silently purring while Jacob listed the names Fiona was currently favouring for the baby. Archie and Harry for a boy, May and Elvie for a girl. Time passed easily, and the steady flow of one-way conversation and the simplicity of Natasha's expression helped take the strain out of the overall hospital experience. It was past noon, and his time was up. Smiling at Natasha a final time, Jacob swept up his Dr. Pepper bottle and breezed to the clunky yellow bin, swinging its lid up and dropping the bottle inside with a thud. Attracted by the noise, Gillian Radson bustled over, cardigan flapping.
"Jacob," she puffed, "I'm glad I caught you."
She smiled knowingly into Jacob's frown, waiting just a few seconds too long.
"The journalist left this card for you. She seemed quite insistent that you might change your mind about talking to her."
The nurse pressed the sharp corners of the business card into Jacob's sweating hand.
"Well, okay. I'll see you next week then."
As Jacob paced out, pushing the double doors of the ward with some force, he looked down into his palm. The card was thick, with slightly embossed lettering in a thick black typeface. Alex Dale, freelance journalist. Telephone 07876 070866. Email alexdalewrites@gmail.com. 15 Axminster Road, Tunbridge Wells, TN2 2YD.
Chapter 7. Amy. 18th July, 1995. Amy bit her lip, tasting the tiniest trace of cherries. She stared up at him from under her hair. Still wearing her uniform, she could feel her knickers cutting into her leg where they'd been pulled out of shape, a new sting between her thighs, the smell of rubber and sweat on her fingers. Under her legs she felt a baby soft duvet. This was without a doubt the worst thing she'd ever done, the meanest, the most secret. Poor Jake, he didn't deserve this. He was such a gentle, trusting boy, just a kid, and she'd punished him for not treating her like a woman. She hadn't really enjoyed being treated like a woman. She heard the soft patter of socked feet in the hall and gasped. A shadow crept under the door and scurried away, and the distant sound of bed springs twinkled. Amy looked up at him for reassurance. "Don't worry," he said in his deep drawl. "The others won't be back for hours." Amy sat up, snapping her knees together. "I thought we were alone." "Don't worry," he smiled. "He knows what's what. We won't be disturbed." Her secret was out of place in this room. A dog-eared box of Lego sat on top of the wardrobe. A framed Star Wars picture hung above the bed. It was pretty neat, and smelled like sweet musk mixed with a tinge of new sweat. Amy stood up with a sigh and straightened her skirt. It had happened, finally. And now she just really wanted to be with her mum, to have a bath, and pretend to be a kid for a little longer. "I need to get home or I'll get in trouble." "Let's get going then." "It's fine, thanks, I'd like to walk." "No, Amy," he shook his head. "Let's give you a lift."
Chapter 8. Alex. 8th of September, 2010. Alex made it home at 12:28 p.m. and parked just outside her terraced house. She was painfully late. Her feet throbbed. Her eyes and throat were dry from concentrating in the strip-lit hospital air. The stone path to her crimson front door was short, but every step pinched her ankle bones, while her black dress tangled around her knees. All she wanted in the world right now was to sink into the cool dark behind the closed curtains. The house had belonged to her mother, but Alex hadn't been raised in it. Her mother had moved back to Tunbridge Wells from Spain when the first cracks appeared in her memory, and dementia was whispered about in breathy, broken English. Alex's mother had wanted to be on home soil, wanted to be near a hospital whose name she could pronounce, and near familiar roads and avenues that she thought she'd be able to find her way around, no matter how bad it got. It got bad very quickly. Alex had moved in for the last months, while dementia punched permanent holes in her mother. She watched her only parent turning inside out, while Matt stayed in their rented flat in South London. When her mother moved into the hospice on the hospital grounds for her bitter end, Alex went too. She'd chronicled the experience in a weekly column for the Sunday Times magazine. Losing Mum. Her most intimate private agonies were also the most lucrative. After Alex's mother died, Matt moved in, and the couple had tried to make the terraced house in Tunbridge Wells their home. Leaving London was easy, for Alex at least. She only lived in the capital because the newspapers were based there, not out of any affection for the place. But Matt had loved living in London, working for the Met Police, surrounded by the constant hum of crime and punishment. He relished buzzing around in an anonymous hive, where nobody outside of his home or station knew his name. Alex couldn't bring herself to sell the place. The house was all that was left, apart from a few bits of jewellery and clothes. Her mother had shed everything else when she had packed up and moved to Andalusia some years before. Coming back to England and choosing that house was the last major decision Alex's mother had made. The last major decision she had been capable of making, and Alex couldn't overturn it. Not yet. The furthest Alex could go was remodeling the two up, two down, with some of her inheritance money. Matt unhappily but dutifully followed. They'd barely lived there 6 weeks before Matt was back in London. Alex had pored over every microfilm clipping she could find on Amy Stevenson, then printed and organized them into sections. So much of it was identical agency copy, topped and tailed for the different papers. But even excluding duplicates, the clippings from the first 2 weeks after her disappearance filled a whole archive box. The Mirror, 20th of July, 1995. Missing teen feared abducted. Scores of local residents are searching for missing schoolgirl Amy Stevenson, 15, who disappeared on her way home from Edenbridge Grammar School in Edenbridge, Kent, on Tuesday. Amy's parents, Joe, 34, and Bob, 33, raised the alarm at 9 p.m. on Tuesday, but were told by police that the teenager was likely to have run away. Joe and Bob told the Mirror that their daughter was a happy teen and would not have run away, claiming that none of her clothes or belongings were missing. Police began searching the nearby area after Amy failed to appear at her home on Wallingham Road, Edenbridge, the next morning. Fears are mounting that Amy may have been abducted, and police are appealing for any witnesses who saw a man, woman, or several adults approaching Amy between 3:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, the 18th of July. Amy is 5'4" tall, slim, with long brown hair and blue eyes. Amy was wearing a navy blue skirt, short-sleeved white blouse, and black shoes with a wood effect wedge heel. She was carrying a black nylon and rubber kickers rucksack and was last seen with her navy Edenbridge Grammar School jumper tied around her waist. If you have seen Amy or saw anything suspicious in the Eden Bridge or wider Kent area, call Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111. Amy's parents were initially treated as a unit. Within a day or so, Bob had become Amy's stepfather.
"It's always the stepdad,"
Alex remembered a nicotine yellow news editor telling her once.
"Sure as death and taxes, abductions are the stepdad, robberies are an inside job, and bodies are found by dog walkers."
The Times, 22nd of July, 1995. Police arrest stepfather for attempted murder. Amy Stevenson's stepfather, Robert Stevenson, has been arrested for questioning about the teenager's disappearance. The arrest follows the discovery of an unconscious young woman in woodland near to where Amy went missing. Police are yet to make a formal statement, but several sources claim it is the missing girl. Mr. Stevenson, 33, had taken part in the search party. It is believed he was less than 100 meters away when the young woman was found. There had been hundreds of clippings about Bob's arrest, from scathing right-wing columns focusing on stepfamilies and the disintegration of the traditional British community, to flimsy eyewitness interviews with unnamed neighbours presented to all but say guilty in blood-red letters. The Star, 25th of July, 1995. Tragic Amy's stepdad in hiding. Stepdad Robert Stevenson, the main suspect in Amy Stevenson's abduction, has gone into hiding following his release by police. The clippings thinned out considerably within weeks of Amy being found. The box containing clippings spanning nearly 15 years was the same size as that for the first 2 weeks. The Sun, 14th of August, 1995. Stepdad did not abduct Amy. Police investigating last month's abduction and sexual assault of Amy Stevenson, 15, have announced they are formally dropping all charges against her stepfather, Robert Stevenson. The unusual move comes amid fears that fresh witnesses will not come forward if they believe Stevenson, 33, is to blame. Alex remembered the Crime Watch episode about Amy's abduction. By then it was fairly old news. Alex had watched the program with her mother, who had taken the opportunity to point out that she had been wholly correct to drill stranger danger into her own daughter from a young age.
"Why was this girl making these bad decisions? How could she have just disappeared in broad daylight?"
Her mother had sloshed her whiskey sour as she concluded,
"No, Alexandra, you mark my words. She went off with someone."
Alex set her two glasses down on the glossy white sideboard. She filled the tall glass with bottled water until it threatened to spill. Carefully, she filled the wine glass with a millimeter-perfect measure of chilled, crisp Chablis. She replaced the heavy-bottomed bottle in the fridge door alongside five identical bottles. Alex had decided this morning, as she carefully wrote out her to-do list for the day, that she would have just one drink first. Then she would go to the landline in her bedroom, which was fixed and not wireless. This would tether her away from the rest of the wine for the duration of the conversation. Stalling in the kitchen, Alex stood by the Belfast sink while she drank. Slow, medicinal gulps. She walked slowly to the carefully arranged desk, picked up her moleskin notepad and pen, then an extra pen, and stepped silently up the staircase. The dove-grey bedroom was, of course, exactly as Alex had left it, but its empty chill still surprised her. The wine and the anticipation brought a giddiness to Alex's gait, and she sat down heavily on the stripped mattress. In her notepad, in careful, thick, black writing, was Matt's mobile number. She had deleted it from her own phone long ago and had no memory for numbers, but had managed to track it down on an old joint insurance policy. If she was deadly honest, this was her chance to prove that she'd moved on, show that she was in control, that she was getting better. But more than any of that, she just wanted to hear his voice again. Her stomach lurched as she pressed the keys on her retro handset. The oppressive dial tone burst repetitively. If he didn't answer quickly, she would... Hello? For a moment, all that came from her mouth was air, a noiseless whoosh. Hi, Matt, it's Alex. She heard each word echo as she forced them out. Oh, okay. Hello, Alex. How are you? I'm okay, thanks. I've only had one glass before you ask. She joked, maybe more spikily than intended. As Matt's polite laugh crackled down the line, she winced. Matt's low, gentle voice used to be hers whenever she wanted it. Until 2.5 years ago, his voice was on tap for her ears, whenever, wherever she needed it. She missed him daily. Of her two great loves, he was the healthy one. I'm really sorry to bother you, but I thought you might be able to help me with something. Alex was doing her best impression of professionalism, keeping her register high and clipped. But she knew all too well that Matt would know all too well that her bottom lip was shaking and tears were pooling inside lower lids. Okay, well, what's the thing? He didn't sound overly disturbed, curious if anything. A contrast to the nightly post-breakup calls that Matt had eventually ignored altogether, leaving Alex to babble, hiccup, and sob incomprehensibly into his voicemail. Well, I've been writing about coma patients. Well, they're not really in comas. They're, well, you'd call them vegetables. They're not brain dead, but they can't move or talk. They're not on life support machines or anything. It's called persistent vegetative state. She drew breath. Okay, I think I've heard of that. We watched something on Five a few months ago, said Matt. We? Who are we? Not her right to ask. Not her right anymore. Her chest hurt. Alex wished she was on the wireless handset and could run downstairs and gulp down a second, third, and fourth drink. Oh, we, eh? She tried to be breezy as tears fell fat and hot onto her lap. Matt laughed politely, more of a snort than a laugh, an acknowledgement. Well, while I was in the ward, I saw a girl I recognized. It was Amy Stevenson. Do you remember her from the news? The girl who was kidnapped and attacked, and then they found her half dead a few days later. She lived near me, but it would have been on the national news too, back when we were teenagers. It rings a bell, but what has this got to do with me? In the background, she heard door slam as Matt sighed. Alex imagined her mother, hand on hip, eyes rolling. Oh, this is a sad sight, she'd say, shaking her head. You must learn when to walk away with your head held high. Alex had weaned herself off Matt once before, cutting off all contact for both their sakes. Now she was putting the gun in her own mouth and pressing his finger onto the trigger. But there was no one else to ask. She'd burned all her bridges with his police friends. She tried to tell herself that was why she was calling him. Well, it's an interesting one. Her attacker has never been caught. The stepdad was taken in and released. The mum died soon after. This girl has just been stuck in this state for 15 years while everyone else has moved on around her. I know it would make a great story, and I know that cold cases are notoriously hard to solve, not that I'm trying to crack the case, but I wanted to see what I could do, see if I could find any new angles to write about. Alex drew a long breath. But where do I fit in? Matt asked, a slight disquiet to his voice. Well, I've got some newspaper clippings from the time, but it would be really good to know things from a police perspective. The lead detective on the case has left the force, and I can't find her anywhere. I wondered if you could look up the case for me, see if there's any information that might be useful, any suspects they didn't track down, or... Christ, Alex! You're asking me to pass you confidential documents. I'm a detective. I'd get myself sacked, or worse. What the hell? Sorry, Matt, I didn't mean to put you in an awkward spot. I didn't expect you to pass me documents or anything. Well, what are you actually asking? Alex didn't know. She'd sorely misjudged Matt's willingness to help her. After everything she'd put him through, she'd still hoped that he'd open himself up like this, just because she asked. She cradled the embarrassment in her belly, because she still thought of him daily, still dreamed of them together, when she ever dreamed. She'd imagined a mutual connection that was apparently entirely one-sided. Just take a look with your detective's hat on. Have a look at the case. It was a long time ago. Policing has moved on, so has technology. You might see something that seems iffy. Matt made a sort of noise. Just have a look. See if you think it's worth exploring. Tell me what you can, if anything, and I'll let you know anything I find out before it goes anywhere near an editor. And I won't mention your name to anyone. Oh, God, Alex, look, it doesn't really work like that. I can't look up police records and then pass them to a journalist. A journalist. She was just a journalist. Of course he couldn't pass information to a journalist. Foolishly, she'd allowed herself to imagine a gradual working relationship emerging. As she'd passed out the night before, she'd even allowed herself to imagine some kind of reconciliation. Memories of her nocturnal naivety made her cringe deeply. After everything she'd done, as if he'd come back. Okay, I'm sorry. I got this wrong. I fucked up. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Look, you don't need to tell me anything that isn't already out there. I'm not a proper reporter, Matt. You know I've not done this stuff before. There must be a lot of information, clues even, just out there in the public domain. But I don't fully know what I'm looking for. Perhaps you could just take a look at the details I've found and let me know what jumps out at you. A pause.
Maybe.
Do you have a pen, Matt? Matt always had a pen. Well, he had always had a pen. A Mont Blanc she'd bought him as a wedding gift. Her name is Amy Jeanette Stevenson. Date of birth, 28th of February, 1980. She lived on Wallingham Road in Edenbridge, Kent. She went missing on the 18th of July in 1995. Her mum was Joanne Stevenson. Father was unknown. Stepdad was Robert Stevenson. He was fingered for it the day she was found, but police released him. No one else was pulled in, according to the press, but I'm guessing they actually grabbed every pedo in a 30-mile radius. And the rest, Matt murmured, audibly scribbling on some paper. Alex's stomach fluttered. As artificial as the situation really was, it felt good to be focusing, digging around. It felt good to be talking to Matt.
Okay, Alex, I'll see what I can do, he said. Look, you know I said we earlier.
Alex didn't want to have this conversation. It's fine, you don't need to tell me anything.
I know I don't, but I'd rather it came from me. I wouldn't want you finding out from someone else.
I never see any of your friends or family. I don't see anyone. Don't worry. He ignored her protestations and blurted out his news.
I'm getting married, Alex. I'm getting married and I'm having a baby.
With the same woman? Alex countered, while her heart shattered and her throat furred. More awkward laughter. I'm really pleased for you. Congratulations. What's her name?
She really, really didn't want to know. Her name's Jane. She's a police officer at my station, so...
Matt stopped. So she understands. So she understands the hours, then? Alex helped him out.
Yeah, something like that.
And when's the baby due?
Next month. We're having a girl.
Matt, I'm so pleased for you. That's lovely news. Congratulations to you both. So, do you have my number, or is it easier to drop me an email if you find anything out about Amy? Alex dragged her nails along the mattress, moving them up to her leg and digging them into her skin to stay focused. She had to hold it together.
I've still got your mobile number, he continued, oblivious.
And your email address if it hasn't changed? I never got round to changing it, even though it is a bit cringy.
Oh, it's fine. It's who you are. Alex Dale Writes.
@gmail.com.
@gmail.com. Anyway, I'll be in touch. It was good to hear from you, Alex.
Thanks, Matt.
Alex?
Yes?
What about the... about you? Are you looking after yourself? I mean, properly. Are you going to appointments? Matt, you don't need to worry about me, okay?
Okay.
Alex put the phone down with a prim click. She lay on the bed, grasped the bare duvet in her fingers and pulled it up over her legs, her belly, her chest, her face. A baby. He was having a baby. With his new wife. A healthy baby and a nice, normal wife. Everything he ever wanted, and always denied needing. Twisting the unsheathed duvet around herself until she was completely swaddled, womb-like. Crying, bucking her body, swallowing tears. Howling, Alex contorted and writhed, trying to twist herself away from the pain until she was spent. Exhausted and nauseous, she threw the duvet from her face and dragged herself from the scratchy mattress like it was cartoon quicksand. She was determined not to think about Matt and his new wife and their new baby. Determined, but damned. The shadows were so long, she didn't know what time it was, or how long she had been lying there. Alex paced into the bathroom. She peed, washed her face with expensive cleansing wash that made her grey skin squeak, and then cantered quickly downstairs. Down to the glass and the bottle next to that. And a fuck it number of bottles after that, too.
Chapter 9. Jacob, 8th of September 2010. Jacob had spent an hour in the ward, and it hadn't been enough. Time is not a good healer. Time is a blank page on which those left behind scribble their regrets and their confessions. This weekly trip to medical purgatory was taking its toll. Jacob had sat with Natasha Carroll as his final patient. He had held her expensive porcelain hand in his and felt his eyes grow watery and heavy. She had kept her peaceful expression, a sacred statue with its face up to someone's god. Natasha Carroll was in a better place, not philosophically or religiously, but mentally. Her thoughts were elsewhere, a summer's dream, set somewhere far more cheerful than this clinical tomb. Jacob, on the other hand, was very much stuck here. After saying goodbye to Natasha and waving to the nurses, he had stumbled out of the hospital and into the bright sunlight. He was not sated, but utterly spent by his time with Amy. Jacob caught sight of his wrung-out reflection in the window. His sandy hair was speckled with a new grey. The skin around his squinting eyes shriveled like burned plastic. Guilt was rotting him from the inside out. He'd staggered just a few feet and then sat down heavily on the gravelly, uneven floor outside the old hospital block, which loomed over him like a prison tower. Cross-legged and perfectly still, shoulders slumped, Jacob's lower back brushed the cool of the crumbling brickwork building. His spine felt anchored, so rooted that if an ambulance suddenly veered towards him, he'd be incapable of moving out of its path. The morning before the hospital visit had been tough. Fiona was allowed half days off work for midwife appointments, and she'd wanted Jacob to take her for brunch after they went for the checkup. The checkup would finish at around 10:45 a.m., and the surgery was at least 10 minutes by car from the hospital, not including parking time. If he'd had brunch with Fiona, he'd not have had any time left to visit. It was that simple. Fiona or Amy. He had decided that he would avoid the hospital this week. He would avoid Amy. He told Fiona that yes, it would be lovely to go for brunch together before they both returned to work. But in the midwife's room at the surgery, he had watched Fiona's tummy shiver as the cold gel was dolloped onto the bump. He had held his breath in the half second before the fetal Doppler whooped into life. He had felt his eyes prickle at the runaway heartbeat of his unborn baby. In a room filled with the very sound of life and potential, he had thought of Amy. He had thought of Amy's heartbeat, weak and whispering. He thought of her years ago when her broken body was threaded with wires and drips and sustained by great hunks of machinery. Back then, her heartbeat was barely audible. The needle that recorded it skittered so sporadically up and down the lined paper that every pause seemed like an end. Right now, Jacob's unborn baby was gearing up for life, armed with this thundering heart, determined little fists, and unspoilt mind. Meanwhile, Amy lay trapped, souring like milk on a windowsill. Jacob's phone trilled, scattering his thoughts away. Fiona. Jacob shook his head, slapped his face a couple of times, and answered.
Hi, sweetheart. What's up?
As he spoke, the liquid gold sunshine prickled all over his bare arms.
I'm sorry to bother you. I was just a bit worried.
He cleared his throat.
You're not bothering me, Fee. Why are you worried? You just seemed so choked up at the surgery this morning, and then when you rushed off, you were so funny with me. I'm not accusing you or having a go. I honestly don't mind about brunch, but you were off. It was like you needed to be away from us as quickly as possible.
Jacob swallowed hard. None of this was Fiona's fault, but at least she was an adult. What kind of man was he to run away from his tiny son or daughter?
Fiona, I'm so sorry. You're right.
He slowed down. He had to remember to pick his words carefully.
It really got me this morning, he continued slowly. It was the heartbeat. It was so strong. I was so amazed and so scared at the same time. I don't know why. The closer it gets to the due date, the more I worry that I'm going to let you both down.
Grey clouds swooped out of nowhere and rushed the sun away like minders. Shadows raced across the hospital yard, and Jacob heard Fiona's voice.
Jacob? Jay? Don't cry. It's okay. Don't cry.
Before he realized it, he was gargling on huge, salty sobs and wiping his gritty eyes with his free hand.
I'm so sorry,
he heard himself burbling.
I'm so sorry.
Jacob had a scheduled face-to-face in half an hour's time at a client's office near the Sussex border. As he made his way into the hospital car park, coughing away the last of the sobs and wiping his eyes with the flesh of his thumb, he called Mark, his colleague, his junior, and asked him to call the client to postpone.
Thanks for doing this, mate. I owe you,
Jacob told him. Mark didn't ask what was wrong, of course, but Jacob knew he'd assume it was something to do with Fiona and the baby, and Jacob didn't put him straight. Another guilty notch on the cot bed. He called Fiona again as he was about to start the engine. He told her to blow work off that afternoon, that he was coming home. She sounded so genuinely concerned that Jacob started sobbing again, head on the steering wheel, and had to wait another 5 minutes before turning the key. Jacob turned slowly into their road, his black company Audi purring its low whir. He could see that Fiona's car, their car, was already in the driveway. A big, black, shining example of another expense they didn't really need and couldn't afford. A 7-seater Volvo XC90, bought on tick the day after their 12-week pregnancy scan. They were only having one baby, he'd protested. They were future-proofing, she argued. And before he knew it, he was signing the hire purchase agreement while she stroked her barely there belly and smiled adoringly at the huge car. His job in field sales for a specialist software company was well paid, but not as well paid as their spending would suggest. When Jacob and Fiona bought the house, before the baby was a twinkle in its mother's eye, they just took care of their respective bills. He earned more, so he paid a few more. A few months after that, fueled by 2 for £10 white wine, Fiona had initiated an almighty row, bemoaning the unromantic financial arrangements. The marriage and the mortgage were not, Fiona had declared, worth squat. The real mark of a lifelong commitment was a joint account. Jacob had argued that this would obliterate the romance of secrecy, that he couldn't buy her a present without it coming off their shared balance, printed clearly on a shared bank statement. "When was the last time you bought me a present?" she'd yelled. "You just don't want me to see your bank statements!" And with an adolescent flounce, she'd run upstairs, thrown herself on their bed, and howled dramatically. At the time, Jacob was terrified. Who was this woman in their house? The Fiona he'd first met was so cool and in control, and would have rolled her eyes at anything resembling a tantrum. If she ever cried, she cried in secret, in the bath. Only her eyes would give her away, and it took him a long time to learn that. Was that other woman, the Fiona he had fallen in love with, just a siren drawing him onto the rocks? After a while, the tantrum had died down, and he had heard Fiona moving frantically around their bedroom. He heard drawers open and close, heard the wardrobe sliding open. It took a few minutes to realize that she was going through his things. She was looking for a bank statement. Jacob had been mystified. He regularly gave her his bank card to get cash out with or pick something up for him. She could have easily checked the balance or got a mini statement, so why would he hide his bank statements? After pouring himself a large whiskey from the expensive Christmas bottle his father, Graham, had given him, Jacob had thrown it to the back of his mouth and trudged wearily up the stairs. He wasn't a whiskey man, and the spirit had burst across his forehead and fogged his thoughts. He had seen Fiona on the floor on her knees in their bedroom, surrounded by bits of paper, old receipts and bills. "Where the fuck are your bank statements?" she'd demanded, with eyes so fierce he'd had to look away. "Fiona, look," he'd begun, trying to shake the whiskey mist.
"Don't say anything. Don't tell me anything other than where your fucking bank statements are."
Her eyes had burned red, and her face was so wet with tears that her shining auburn hair had stuck to it. He had walked out of their newly decorated bedroom and into their smaller spare room, which had been appropriated as a makeshift office. Slowly, so that he didn't make any mistakes, he wrote down a web address, username, password, and PIN. He walked back into the bedroom, placed the piece of paper next to Fiona's foot, and said carefully, "I haven't been sent paper statements for years because I get them online. Here are my internet banking details so you can see my statements for the last few years and can check my account any time. If that's what you need to do, then that's what you need to do." Jacob had hoped this would snap Fiona out of it, put a stop to this, and realize how sad an end to their honeymoon period this would represent. It didn't work. For the next 3 weeks, Fiona had audited his every transaction, calling him over to the screen frequently so he could explain every pound and penny. They got a joint bank account after that. Financially, at least, Jacob had nothing to hide. Jacob didn't know how long he had been sitting outside his house, staring at the back of the big Volvo and gripping his steering wheel with white knuckles. He knew that Fiona was waiting inside. Jacob opened the front door and walked slowly into the hall. The Fiona on the phone earlier had sounded like his Fiona. Now, with her back to the door so her bump was invisible, she even looked like the old Fiona. Jacob stayed standing in the hallway. Fiona span around a little unsteadily so that the bump swung into view. "Hey," he called quietly. and as she walked to his open arms, he saw that she had been crying. "Fee," he started, pulling her into a hug. "Don't," she answered quietly. "Just cuddle me." They stayed locked in a tight hug for a long time, saying nothing.
Chapter 10. Amy, 18th of July, 1995. "You're very quiet, Amy. I feel really bad." "You don't need to feel bad. No one will blame you." Amy closed her eyes and turned her head towards the passenger window. Her shoulders faced the door and the seatbelt cut into her chest. No hand on her knee, no murmuring in her ear. Tears began to form and she struggled to hold them in. He shouldn't have been there. Why was he there? No answer came. "I shouldn't have done this. You won't be able to help me now." She started to sob again. "You're overthinking this." Sniffing, she scrunched her eyes as tight as she could. These could be her last few hours before the shit hit the fan and she wanted to sink into the darkness of them as much as she could. What would the others say when they heard? Everything was about to change. No one would keep her secrets for her. She should never have got into the car. She should never have gone there and she should never have had sex with him. So many things she shouldn't have done in such a short space of time. Amy opened her eyes and saw the dull brick outskirts of Edenbridge falling away. "Where are we going? I need to get home." "Somewhere nice. You'll like it." "I have to go home, though. Please, can you just turn the car around?" That would spoil the surprise. His voice was once the source of such dizzying excitement. That voice, her hanging up the phone with seconds to spare as Bob's key clattered in the lock. Leaving her so flustered she had to scuttle to her room to hide. Now the voice just sounded mean and patronizing. "I'm sorry," she said, turning to face him but unable to make eye contact. "I don't want to spoil whatever the surprise is, but I really have to go home. You can just leave me here if you have to. I can walk." "I can't do that, Amy," he said, and turned to flash her the briefest of smiles.
Chapter 11. Alex. 9th of September, 2010. Alex woke early, a surge of adrenaline forcing her to sit upright before she had a chance to slip back under. Her bed was dry for once, and she checked her emails on the phone as she sat on the loo. As soon as she opened the inbox, she saw Matt's name. The email had been sent at 5:32 a.m., presumably after he returned home from a night shift. Where was home? Alex wondered, realizing she knew so little about Matt's life. His name in her inbox seemed so right. Barely exciting, just normal. From Matthew Livingston to Alex Dale. Subject, Amy. "Hey, Alex. Good to talk to you yesterday. Forgot to ask what you're up to. Sorry about that. Like I said, I have to be careful. But here are some bits and pieces I found to get you started. Please keep this confidential. I'm trusting you with this. It seems like there were three main suspects. One, the stepdad, who you know about. Robert Stevenson, known as Bob, born 22nd of the 1st, 1962. You know as well as I do that it's almost always someone who knows the victim. It's more often birth dads than stepdads, depending on who you listen to. But the stepdad is always going to be in the frame unless he has a cast iron alibi. They would have bugged him, followed him, gone through every job he'd had, spoken to ex-girlfriends, all sorts. Looks like he was squeaky clean, because they made a big thing of publicly clearing him later. But I suspect the damage was done, and most people thought, no smoke without fire. Two, a neighbour in the road Amy lived in, John Rochester, known as Jack. Local nonce, peeping Tom, long track record of low-level child abuse, taking pictures in parks, flashing, that kind of thing.
He was eliminated as a suspect because he was physically too frail to have assaulted a healthy young girl.